It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 879 for the 26th of April, 2024. This week, a surprising number of Facebook accounts are being stolen, and recovering them is difficult, if not impossible. That's why it's better to avoid trouble in the first place. In short circuits, although your internet service provider includes domain name services, there's a good reason to use one of several alternate services. And efforts by the federal government to eliminate junk fees have finally resulted in some changes that affect what service providers must tell you before you sign up. The number of hacked Facebook accounts seems to have expanded almost exponentially in recent months. Having an account cloned is still more common, but I've seen a surprising number of people who have created new accounts because their existing accounts have been stolen and they can't retrieve them. You can take actions now to make your Facebook account harder to hack and make it possible to recover the account if it is hacked someday. These tasks do take some time to complete, but it's faster and a lot less trouble than having to recover a stolen account, if you can even recover it. Recovery might not be possible if you're not prepared. If or when your Facebook account is hacked, getting it back depends on how accurate the information is that you've given Meta. So do this now. It's worth checking occasionally to ensure that the information Meta has for you is up to date, and definitely worth updating the information when you move, your email address changes, your phone number changes, or your name changes. You'll receive a message from Meta if a thief changes your email address or password, but you might not see the message soon enough to react before it expires. If that happens, you can try the recovery process, but don't even bother if your name and date of birth on your account doesn't match what's shown on a driving license or other government ID. There's no point in trying if your proof of identity doesn't match what Meta has. So check the information that's associated with your account, make sure it's up to date. Then, if you haven't yet set up two-factor authentication, do so. This doesn't guarantee that your account will be safe and never stolen, but it does make stealing the account a lot harder. Okay, so speaking of two-factor authentication, you need to set it up. To do that, you'll need an authenticator app, such as the Google Authenticator, or a password manager that supports two-factor authentication. 1Password is an example of that. You'll find links to both Google Authenticator and 1Password on the TechBiter Worldwide website. And here's what you have to do to set it up in Facebook. Log into Facebook and click the down arrow on your account image. Then choose Settings and Privacy, click Settings, then click Password and Security, and then click Password and Security again on the next panel. And yes, I would like to have a word with the Meta User Interface Designer about that. Next, choose Two-Factor Authentication, then select Authenticator App. The image you'll see on the TechBiter Worldwide website shows that Two-Factor Authentication is already on. That's because I already had it enabled. Select your account on the next panel, then re-enter your password. You'll see a QR code and a long alphanumeric key. Which one you use and how you proceed will be determined by the authenticator application you use, so I have to leave that up to you. When you've finished the process with the authenticator application, obtain a code from it and paste it into Facebook. Each code is good for 30 seconds. Facebook will then tell you that two-factor authentication has been enabled, and you'll probably think you're done, but not quite. Select Additional Methods, and then click Recovery Codes. This is important. This final step involves copying the recovery codes and storing them securely. 1Password has an option to create a secure note inside a password entry. That's where I store my recovery codes. And they do need to be stored securely, because a scammer who gains access to the codes can lock you out of your own account. So now, let's take a look at what happens if somebody does hack your account. But before we do that, make sure the account really has been hacked. If people tell you they've been receiving friend requests from you, even though you're already Facebook friends, the account has been cloned, not hacked. A cloned account is one created by a scammer using your profile picture and information they find in your account. The scammer then impersonates you and invites your friends to connect with them. When an account has been hacked, the thief has full access to your entire account. This happens when the attacker gains control by obtaining your login credentials, and often that happens through phishing emails, although they do have a few other techniques they can use. So if your account has been hacked, the first thing not to do is create a new Facebook account using the same email as your hacked account. If you do, that new account is now your account. Only one account can be associated with any given email address, so creating a new account disconnects your email address from your original account. Recovery is unlikely in that case. If you no longer have access to the email address that Facebook has on file for you, well, there's another stopper. You're not going to be able to recover the account if you can't get to your email. So, check the email address that Facebook has for you. There should already be an email there saying somebody changed your account password and asking if it was you. The message will explain that you need to visit the Facebook website if you didn't make the change. But Facebook sets a very short time limit on the response time, and the message may have expired by the time you see it. If it has, make sure you take a screenshot of the message. If you created a new Facebook account, there is still a slim chance that you'll be able to recover the old account, but before proceeding, log out of that new account. Go to the Facebook recovery page. You'll find a link to that on the TechBiter Worldwide website. Select the option that describes how you became aware that your account had been hacked. Work through the process as it appears on your screen. You should eventually find a form to fill out. Provide the date and approximate time that your account was compromised, the original email address that Facebook has for you, a screenshot of the email that says your information has been changed, and a clear photo or scan of a government ID that shows the name and address that Facebook has on file for you. That is why it's important to keep your information with Facebook up to date. In the message, you'll want to request a password reset link be sent to the email address that Facebook has on file for you. The Facebook procedures change frequently, and Facebook does not offer any type of live tech support. Any online offers that you encounter to help you restore your account are, by definition, fraudulent. So from this point on, all you can do is read everything carefully and follow the directions explicitly. If you don't receive a response from Facebook within an hour, repeat the process. Sometimes it takes several iterations to recover an account, and sometimes it takes several iterations and nothing happens. So that's why it's better to do everything in your power to avoid having your account stolen, rather than spending hours trying, perhaps unsuccessfully, to recover it. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, your internet service provider offers a modem, and I explained a few weeks ago why you might be better off providing your own. The ISP also offers a domain name service server, but you might be better off using somebody else's. DNS is what converts a name such as techbiter.com, which means absolutely nothing to the internet, to an IP address such as 67.222.41.89, which does mean a lot to the internet. The internet understands IP addresses. Think of it as how you'd use a phone book. Remember those? Or whitepages.com these days to find somebody's phone number. Of course, you do have to pay if you want the website to give you any useful information. Or think about the earliest phone systems, the ones that used phones with cranks on the side and had operators who answered with, "Number, please?" The caller gave the operator a name, and the operator made the connection. When you type techbiter.com into the address line of your browser and press Enter, the browser's request is intercepted by the DNS, which has a gigantic lookup table that lists Internet protocol addresses of nearly every known domain. The DNS forwards your browser's request to the Internet backbone that has its own routing tables that explain, in computer speak, how to get to 67.222.41.89. The trouble with your ISP's DNS is that it allows the ISP to see everything sent from or received by your computer. The ISP can then sell this information to advertisers or use it to insert ads. Now, this is less of a problem than it once was, but it can still happen. Additionally, the DNS servers operated by some ISPs are inefficient or slow or both. Third-party domain name services are generally better. One silly example, type googko.com into your browser's address bar. Google has registered a lot of near-miss domain names, but not googko.com, in which there are two significant typo errors. Many ISPs will just return a 404 not found error. But some third-party DNS systems will return a custom error page, while others may actually intuit that you're actually looking for Google and ask if you'd like to go there. Many third-party DNS providers also keep track of sites frequently used for scams, and they'll warn you and ask if you want to proceed. Two of the best-known third-party domain name system providers are OpenDNS and Google, but there are others, lots of others. Selecting an alternate DNS provider involves making a change on your computer or on the router. You'll specify two IP addresses for the third-party DNS server that you prefer. I have a list of those this week on the TechBiter Worldwide website for AdGuard DNS, Alternate DNS, Clean Browsing DNS, Cloudflare, Google DNS, OpenDNS, Quad9 DNS, and VeriSign. And that's just a handful. There are lots more. To change a single computer, take a look at How To Geek's explanation. You'll find a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. It's an old article, but the basics are still correct. It's generally more efficient to make the change on the router, so I'll demonstrate that with the TP-Link Archer AX6000 router. Your router probably will be a little different, but every router will have similar settings. Start by opening the router's control panel. You may need to examine the router's documentation, but the control panel will usually be accessed by connecting to IP address 192.168.0.1 or 192.168.1.1. And if you've never changed the router's administrative password, do that while you're in the neighborhood. Most manufacturers create an administrator account that's almost always called admin. That makes sense. But they have a password of admin or password. Leaving those in place is dangerous. Very dangerous. You probably can't change the username, but you can change the password, so do that. Once those housekeeping measures are out of the way, look for an item on the menu called Internet, or WAN, or Modem, or External. In other words, something that clearly implies the outbound signal. Click that, and then locate the section that refers to the DNS address. Get automatically from ISP is probably what will be selected, and that's what you want to change. Click the option to specify your own DNS servers and then fill in the IP addresses for one of the third-party providers. The user interface may have spaces for 3 DNS entries. You generally need only 2. Use the IP addresses I've shown on the TechBiter Worldwide website, and if the router interface has 3 slots for a DNS IP address, you can add a 3rd. You can also mix and match the services if you want to. Primary DNS will be queried first. The secondary is queried only if the primary fails to respond. And if you enter a 3rd, that 3rd DNS entry is queried only if both of the others fail. The federal government is trying to force companies to drop junk fees, or at least make sure that consumers are well aware of them. Those $35 overdraft fees from banks, for example, you know it doesn't cost them that much to decline a transaction. So does the bank, and many banks have eliminated them. Now, internet service providers are being required to notify consumers about fees and any introductory price offers. You know, the situations in which you sign up for an introductory offer and find that the price nearly doubles at the end of the introductory period. That information must be provided now in plain English, and the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, has adopted forms that look a lot like nutrition labels found on food and over-the-counter supplements. In addition to the monthly fee price and taxes, the ISP forms must include details about activation fees, early termination fees, contract length, and when any discounted fee offer expires. AT&T is pushing their upcoming fiber options in my neighborhood, and those who visit the website will see nutrition labels for their 3 service levels. The forms include rental prices for equipment, such as modems or Wi-Fi routers. ISPs are unhappy about being forced to tell the truth, but now they are required to show upload and download speeds, data caps, and how much a consumer will be charged for any overages. ISPs had proposed providing a long page of small text, such as those you get from banks, you know, the ones that bury important information in a flood of legalese. The FCC rejected that. Major ISPs must show the information labels now. Smaller companies, ones that have fewer than 100,000 customers, still have until October of this year to comply. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.